Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society Civil Rights Practice Group is hosting a discussion on birthright citizenship. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal issues or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. In today's podcast, we're going to hear first from Dr. John C. Eastman. Dr. Eastman is the Donald P. Kennedy Chair in Law at Chapman University School of Law. He's also the founding director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, a public interest law firm affiliated with the Claremont Institute. He's going to speak to us for 6 to 8 minutes in his opening remarks. After that, we'll hear from James C. Ho, who is a partner in the Dallas office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. He's also logged a decade of government experience, most recently and quite recently, as Solicitor General of Texas. Welcome, gentlemen, and can you get us started, Dr. Eastman?
Thanks, Dean, very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting the podcast on what I think is a very extremely important and timely issue. My interest in the issue of birthright citizenship and what the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment means dates back to shortly after 9/11, when in a battle near Kunduz, Afghanistan, between the Northern Alliance forces with whom the United States was allied and a Taliban unit, a gentleman by the name of Yasser Isam Hamdi was captured and with a Kalashnikov AK-47 rifle in his hand. He was screened first by the Northern Alliance forces, handed over to U.S. forces, ultimately ended up at Guantanamo Bay. When they discovered that Mr. Hamdi had been born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the United States government just assumed that he was a citizen, and they transferred him up to Norfolk, a naval brig in Virginia, and a different kind of case than would have existed if he'd not been a citizen went up to the Supreme Court of the United States on the assumption that he was a citizen merely by virtue of his birth on U.S. soil. His parents had been visiting from Saudi Arabia in 1980 when he was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. His father was on a temporary work visa to work for one of the oil companies down in Louisiana. And so the question is whether birth alone creates automatic citizenship in the United States was presented very forcefully in that case. And it's important to look at what the text of the 14th Amendment actually says. It doesn't say, of course, birth alone. It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States, that's the birth part, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state in which they reside. And, of course, it's that subject to the jurisdiction phrase that has created the current controversy. What exactly does it mean? Well, on first blush, everybody that's within the territorial boundaries of the United States is subject to our jurisdiction in some portion. If you've got a tourist visiting from Great Britain, for example, while they're here in the United States, they have to drive on the right side of the road rather than the left side of the road in conformity with our traffic laws. They have subjected themselves to the territorial jurisdiction of the United States by being present here. But they haven't subjected them to the broader jurisdiction, the complete jurisdiction in the United States. We can't draft them into our army, for example. They don't get to vote. We can't prosecute them for treason. They're not subject to the more complete jurisdiction. And because there are two meanings of that phrase, just stand alone, it's inherently ambiguous. And we have to look to what the drafters of that phrase intended in order to, for true originalists to follow what the 14th Amendment actually means. And if you look at the debates, they were asked this question: do you mean partial or territorial jurisdiction, or do you mean complete, this kind of allegiance owing jurisdiction, the shorthand I've put on it? And the authors of the bill that became the 14th Amendment, the drafters of the precise language that became the Citizenship Clause, all said that it means this broader, complete jurisdiction, not the partial or territorial jurisdiction, and that it followed the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which the 14th Amendment was designed in part to constitutionalize in that sense. That act read very clearly, all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are declared to be citizens of the United States. And the change in the language, from not subject to any foreign power to being subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, from the negative to the positive, was not designed to alter the meaning. It was designed to address the issue that the Indian tribes were considered domestic sovereigns, even though subordinate sovereigns, not foreign sovereigns or foreign powers. And so they fixed that with the change in language. But there's no indication in those debates that they did anything other than that, that they intended to confer automatic citizenship on people who were here only as visitors, and certainly no indication in the debates that they intended to confer automatic citizenship on people who were not even legally authorized to be in the United States at all. And so what we're looking for is the ability to press the courts to, for the first time, give us the interpretation of whether the children of illegal immigrants who are not lawfully present in the United States at all meet this test of complete jurisdiction owed to the United States in the sense that I believe the 14th Amendment envisioned. Now, the first couple of times the courts looked at this question in the Slaughterhouse cases in 1873 and in a case called Elk versus Wilkins in 1884, they agreed that it meant subject to this complete jurisdiction, not the mere partial or territorial jurisdiction. In an 1898 case called Wong Kim Ark, the court held that the child of a lawful permanent resident was also a citizen by virtue of the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment. And then in dicta, language suggested that birth was all that was required. But again, that was dicta because it wasn't at issue. The child in Wong Kim Ark was the child of a lawful permanent resident, not somebody who was here illegally and therefore without authority and without being subject to the jurisdiction of the United States in this broader sense. Since then, there have been a couple of cases at the Supreme Court, and footnotes or dicta have kind of reiterated that position that birth is sufficient, but those are not holdings of the Supreme Court. They were dicta. The issues presented in those cases were different ones. And so we've never had a definitive ruling out of the Supreme Court of the United States that tells us whether subject to the jurisdiction meant partial and territorial, like some have come to believe, or whether it meant this more complete jurisdiction that the drafters of the amendment said. And we've designed recently a three-part strategy to kind of get that issue before the courts. I was at a press conference recently with a number of state legislators from the State Legislators for Legal Immigration, an organization of legislators from over 40 states designed to try and press the federal government to grapple with the difficult issues of illegal immigration and to expand our legal immigration and streamline our legal immigration processes. And strategy one of those was for the states to define what state citizenship means consistent with the 14th Amendment. Part two of the strategy was to design a multi-state compact where states would agree to add a designation on their birth certificates, not just that someone was born on U.S. soil, but was born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States as the 14th Amendment intended it. And they define what that is using the language from the debate to the 14th Amendment. And then the third piece of the strategy was a bill introduced in Congress the very next day doing the same thing on the federal level. And so I think finally, by the time this is all finished, we will be able to get a definitive court ruling about what subject to the jurisdiction means. And I think this is extremely important. One of the draws, the magnets for illegal immigration, has been this lottery ticket of American citizenship that comes with what I view as the erroneous interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And when you think about it, it undermines our notion in the Declaration of Independence that governments are founded in consent when somebody can unilaterally demand citizenship that we have not extended or offered to them. And it's a throwback to the old feudal notion that once born on the king's soil, you are always the king's subject. That was a principle that we rejected in the Declaration of Independence. The consent-based model offered by the philosopher John Locke is what we adopted in the Declaration, and I think it ends up codified in the 14th Amendment. It's the one that makes most sense and is most consistent with our founding principles, and I hope the court will ultimately agree and articulate what the floor of the 14th Amendment is, and then leave it to Congress as a policy judgment how far above that floor we want to go in the extension of citizenship to peoples from other parts of the world. But it will be done under their powers over naturalization, not under the mandatory citizenship that comes under the 14th Amendment.
Thank you, Dr. Eastman. Mr. Ho?
Well, I too want to thank you, Dean, and the Federalist Society for putting together this very timely podcast on a very timely issue, certainly a very emotional issue. And I want to thank Dr. Eastman, who has always been a worthy adversary in this and so many other issues. He's also a good friend, so it's always fun to appear with him, and when necessary, to disagree with him vociferously. And I do disagree with him vociferously on this issue, but let me actually begin first with somewhat of an olive branch. And that's to say that many Americans are obviously very sincere and well-meaning when they have concerns about the rule of law and how illegal immigration poses a challenge to the rule of law. I have those concerns myself. I'm a lawyer as well as an immigrant, and I appreciate very deeply and very profoundly that America is a nation of laws as well as a nation of immigrants. But of course, there are many different tools available to combat illegal immigration. And my only point here is that surely we can find a way to deal with the problems that we face without wasting taxpayer funds on a losing court battle, without reopening the scars of the Civil War, which gave birth to the 14th Amendment that we're now threatening to challenge, and without offending our Constitution and the rule of law. Indeed, I would submit it's a bit ironic and curious that proponents of this proposal would, on the one hand, champion the rule of law, and yet with the very same breath, turn around and put forth a proposal that, at least I would submit, violates our Constitution. So let me turn to that. With respect to the legal issues before us, I think John and I can agree on how to understand the terms and understand the terms of debate. I think the dispute can be boiled down in this way. I think everyone agrees that the 14th Amendment does provide for a constitutional right to citizenship, and it does require two elements in order to trigger that constitutional birthright citizenship entitlement. And everyone agrees that the first element is that you have to be born in the United States. The dispute is over the second requirement, which the 14th Amendment says is that you have to be subject to the jurisdiction of the United States at the time of your birth. Now, some people say, what I say, is that all that subject to the jurisdiction means is that you have to be born with the legal duty to obey United States law. Others, like Dr. Eastman, say that the duty to obey U.S. law is irrelevant to the analysis. They say that your parents actually have to be a U.S. citizen themselves. And so they say, in essence, that the word subject to the jurisdiction means, essentially, political allegiance. Now, my message today is simple. It's that every traditional tool of legal analysis available points in the same direction. It points in the direction that birthright citizenship is, in fact, a matter of constitutional right. And it is so no less for the children of undocumented persons as it is for descendants of passengers on the Mayflower. In sum, the test is obedience, not allegiance. And that is so as a matter of constitutional text, common law history, the congressional debates, Supreme Court precedent, and executive branch interpretation. And I'll take each of those quickly in turn. I'll do the text quickly because I was pleased to hear Dr. Eastman saying that his position, he believes, can't be supported based on text alone. He I think, admits or submits anyway that there are at least potential alternative definitions of the text, and you have to really go sort of beyond the text. But I'll briefly just note that as a textual matter, certainly the plainer, more straightforward meaning of the phrase subject to the jurisdiction would mean duty to obey U.S. law. If we say, as a matter of common parlance, that a particular company is subject to the jurisdiction of the FCC, all we're saying is that that company is required to follow the laws and orders of the FCC. We're certainly not saying that the company has or does not have a certain immigration status. We're certainly not saying that that company has sworn allegiance to the FCC. We're not even saying that that company has ever complied with past FCC orders. We're just saying that the company is subject to the jurisdiction of the FCC. Now, Professor Eastman has provided a alternative definition, this issue of allegiance, and he claims that the congressional debates support that. So let me turn to the common law history of this provision, as well as the congressional debates. I think it's important to note that the 14th Amendment wasn't an innovation. It didn't create this doctrine out of nowhere. It merely codified the centuries-old English common law doctrine of jus soli. And that doctrine provided for birthright citizenship for every British citizen or every person born on British soil. And it provided birthright citizenship, British citizenship, to that person, including those born to foreigners. The common law exception was for individuals born to foreign diplomats or foreign combatants. And that's for the simple reason that they did not have to obey British law. And so too, under the 14th Amendment, it excludes those who are not obliged to follow U.S. law, foreign diplomats, foreign combatants. The English common law doctrine was part of our early American colonial practice and then early state practice. And then came along Dred Scott, when the U.S. Supreme Court denied U.S. citizenship to the U.S.-born children of slaves. Congress adopted the 14th Amendment to ratify and to constitutionalize jus soli and to overrule Dred Scott. Now, the congressional debates, I agree with Dr. Eastman that that's really the scope of the discussion amongst both sides of this issue. I think the congressional debate, fairly read, confirms two things. It confirms that Congress intended to include foreign nationals in the Birthright Citizenship Clause, expressly including the Chinese. And Congress also intended to exclude Indians, who enjoy a unique legal status due to tribal sovereignty. Now, in the main debates about the Citizenship Clause, both supporters and opponents actually agreed that the Citizenship Clause would codify the doctrine of jus soli. And in fact, there was actually an explicit debate over whether U.S.-born children to foreign nationals would be covered and should be covered as a policy matter. The House actually passed the 14th Amendment without a citizenship clause, so this came up in the Senate when Senator Howard introduced his language, the citizenship clause that we now know, and he introduced it by explaining what he meant, which is the express understanding of jus soli, that it would cover foreign citizens as opposed to foreign diplomats. Senator Cohen, using some rather racially strident language, opposed this language, and he opposed it specifically because he did not want the children born in the United States to Chinese nationals to have citizenship. He agreed that that's what the clause would do, and he disagreed with that clause as a matter of policy. Senator Conness of California responded, took up this charge by saying that Senator Cohen was exactly right, that the clause would provide the U.S.-born children of foreign Chinese nationals, would provide them U.S. citizenship at birth. He simply agreed that that was good policy, that we should extend that right. The Senate adopted the clause and rejected Senator Cohen's policy position. So bottom line is there was a consensus in Congress that the citizenship clause would in fact cover foreign citizens, so long as they were not diplomats or otherwise entitled to immunity against U.S. law. The debate in Congress, in short, was not over the meaning of the citizenship clause. Rather, it was only debate about its wisdom. Now, there is a second discussion in the debates about the status of Indians and the unique tribal issues of sovereignty that Indians present. And it's during that discussion that there is this language that Dr. Eastman quotes about allegiance. And I fully acknowledge that that word, allegiance, appears in that portion of the debate. My point here is that those references do not alter the main point, which is that Congress expressly contemplated covering foreign populations like the Chinese. And moreover, it did so specifically because they were codifying jus soli. So I think the most that one can say about the congressional debates is that they reflect a conflict in the legal reasoning that the members of Congress used during the first conversation and the second conversation. But even if the legal reasoning was somewhat confused and conflicting, the holdings of those debates, if you will, are clear. Foreign nationals are covered. Foreign diplomats and combatants are not covered. And domestic Indian tribes are likewise not covered. With respect to Supreme Court precedent, I'll just briefly note that Dr. Eastman acknowledges that Wong Kim Ark rejects his position, at least with regard to lawful residents. I'll just make two comments about Wong Kim Ark. First of all, he notes that there are two earlier cases, Slaughterhouse and Elk, which he prefers over the later Wong Kim Ark. Slaughterhouse, of course, wasn't about the citizenship clause. It does have some dicta that supports him, but it was never teed up as an issue. And Elk versus Wilkins was about Indian tribes. And if he said that Elk versus Wilkins was correctly decided, well, notably, it was authored by Justice Gray, the same person who authored Wong Kim Ark. And of course, my submission here is that both cases were correctly decided. I don't see how Wong Kim Ark can be limited to the lawful resident context. Certainly, the analysis is broader than that. It embraces the use solely that we've talked about here. And in any event, the U.S. Supreme Court has taken that doctrine further in cases like Plyler versus Doe and INS versus Rios Pineda. Those cases, admittedly, were not teeing up the citizenship clause question directly, but unquestionably, the court in both cases concluded that the 14th Amendment does extend to anyone so long as they are subject to the laws of a state, and that, of course, includes the U.S.-born children of illegal aliens. I think I will end by noting Dr. Eastman's reference to the state effort, this multi-state concerted effort. And I acknowledge his point that, you know, opponents of birthright citizenship say all they want is their day in court. And obviously, who can question that? All they want is an opportunity to relitigate the meaning of the 14th Amendment, see if the U.S. Supreme Court will change its mind. I would simply submit that if that's their goal, state legislation is actually a pretty poor strategy. After all, if you think about it, determining U.S. citizenship is the unique province of the federal government. I don't think it takes a constitutional expert to appreciate we can't have 50 different state laws governing who is a citizen. I can't be in California and think that I'm a citizen there, but walk into Arizona and all of a sudden I'm no longer a citizen. I think courts would readily strike that down without ever even invoking the 14th Amendment. And so this state-based enterprise to relitigate the 14th Amendment seems doomed to failure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ho.
Well,
Dr. Eastman, do you want to offer some rebuttal here?
I certainly do. And, you know, first, some points of agreement. I agree that if Jim's right about the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, then the state efforts to define the 14th Amendment's floor differently would be unconstitutional. But he did concede that Wong Kim Ark dealt with the children of lawful residents, that Plyler versus Doe and INS versus Rios Pineda was dicta. What that means is that the holding on the precise question at issue, whether subject to the jurisdiction also includes the children of people who are not legally authorized to be here, or the people who are here only temporarily without subjecting themselves to the complete jurisdiction, has not been decided by the court. And of course, if I'm right about what the 14th Amendment means, then the state efforts to define that very question would not be unconstitutional. They would be clarifying a long-standing provision of the law that has not been interpreted definitively by the Supreme Court of the United States. And if we're right about that, it would not be unconstitutional. It would be constitutional what they're doing. The second is Professor Ho, Jim Ho, Solicitor General Ho disagrees or agrees that the two debates he points to are in tension under his interpretation of the law. And then he tries to reconcile that by saying, well, the one is kind of a unique case on the Indians and the other is what the principle ought to be that governs us on all the rest of the cases. Interestingly, though, my interpretation of the clause reconciles those two debates, and let me give you the summary on how that is. First of all, nowhere in the debates do they refer explicitly to the jus soli doctrine, and I agree with Jim that this is the old common law rule. And in the United States, we adopt the common law to the extent it is consistent with the principles that we set out in our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. The big question is the notion of consent-based creation of government, rather than feudal, oh, allegiance to the king no matter what, is that one of the critical principles of the Declaration of Independence? I submit it is, and it, in fact, it clearly is. It took the common lawyers and the common law courts a while to figure that out. But by the time we get to the 14th Amendment, they had realized the contradiction in having a feudal-based system, jus soli, and the consent-based principles of the Declaration of Independence. And I submit to you what they were adopting when they say not just birth, but subject to the jurisdiction, is they were adopting the Lockean consent-based version. And so if you look at the early debate, and the Cohen-Conness debate is actually about the 1866 Act rather than the 14th Amendment language, but the principle is the same. He was asking, you're going to give citizenship to the children of gypsies and Chinese, aren't you? And they said yes. Jim wants to say that they were giving the citizenship to foreign nationals, but that's not the way the debate goes forward. Cohen says, who owe their allegiance to no one, gypsies and Chinese. They were here lawfully, and they were here permanently. They had submitted to the jurisdiction in this broader sense of the United States. Their children met the definition. The issue that was underway in that debate was the old version, the Dred Scott version, which was the body politic was only white citizens. Dred Scott was wrong on that, but that was the holding in Dred Scott, and it was what the 14th Amendment was designed to repudiate, that this was not a white European-only government grounded in consent, but it was open to everybody who was here lawfully and permanently. And so when they answer, yes, of course it will apply to the children of gypsies and Chinese, just like it will apply to the children of French or English or Irish, it's that proposition that they are asserting and the full repudiation of the Dred Scott decision. But they say nothing more about it. They don't deal with temporary residents, and they don't deal with those who are here unlawfully. So I don't think even that first discussion is inconsistent with my statements. I think it fully vindicates it. And then when you turn to the second discussion, it becomes even more clear that they adopted the consent-based model for defining our body politic. Now, it is true that it occurred in the context of Indians living on reservations rather than an illegal immigrant context, because we didn't have an illegal immigrant population at the time. In fact, we were still in the mode of encouraging as great a migration to this country to fill out the space between our shores as we possibly could. But so we have to draw from analogy with the kind of discussion and philosophical principles that are being pressed with the Indian discussion. And when they were asked about this, would Indians living on the reservation, and remember the reservation was where the tribe was, they owed their direct allegiance to the tribe, but the tribes in turn owed allegiance to the United States. They were domestic dependent sovereigns. And so in that sense, they were, to use Jim's definition of subject to the jurisdiction, they were subject to the laws of the United States. Derivatively, but much more clearly than somebody who's here unlawfully. They were asked this direct question. Would the Indians be covered? Since they are most clearly subject to our jurisdiction, both civil and military. That was the question put. Senator Lyman Trumbull responded that subject to the jurisdiction meant its complete jurisdiction, not owing allegiance to anybody else. The Indians were not covered because they owed allegiance directly to their tribe, not to the United States, even though derivatively they owed allegiance to the United States. The case for citizenship there is much stronger than the case for citizenship for somebody who is here unlawfully within the United States who continues to owe their allegiance to their home country. And yet in the debates we learn that the children of Indians born on the reservations are not going to be automatic citizens. Senator Howard, who actually introduced the language on the floor, reiterates that position. It meant full and complete jurisdiction, the same jurisdiction in extent and quality as applies to every citizen of the United States now. So we're not going to make racial or national origin qualifications and distinctions. Everybody that is here lawfully and permanently under the 1866 Civil Rights Act, born here and not subject to any foreign power, are going to be citizens under this clause as well. But it's that full and complete jurisdiction that he describes that they're codifying into the 14th Amendment, not a reiteration of the birth principle, which is where jus soli is, but a consent-based principle, which is what subject to the jurisdiction was intended to mean. So my position actually makes sense of both of those two debates, and it doesn't create any tension or conflict between the two. They were adopting the consent-based proposition that is set out in our Declaration of Independence, and it's also good policy, and this doesn't require Congress not to be willing to extend citizenship beyond that. But we do that as a matter of policy, and therefore with our consent, not because the Constitution has set a floor so high that everybody in the world that wants to come here will be automatic citizens upon doing so, even if the act of getting here violates our law and demonstrates that we haven't consented to the very act by which they're claiming citizenship. The consent principle matters. Like I say, it's at the heart of the Declaration of Independence break from Great Britain. And I think we finally codified that in the 14th Amendment.
Terrific. Mr. Ho, you want to take a few minutes and respond to Dr. Eastman?
Yeah, I'll just do it briefly since I know I took a long time earlier. Let me mention this feudalism issue since Dr. Eastman's mentioned it a couple of times. I think he argues that, you know, this is a feudalistic concept, which we obviously rejected when we declared our independence from Britain. Now, of course, what we rejected, what is feudal, is the notion of being a subject of a king. And that's something that's a legal status that you cannot escape. There are no exit rights from being a king's subject. We're not talking about that here, of course. We're not talking about exit rights. There are rights to renounce U.S. citizenship if you don't want it. That's what we rejected, the notion that you didn't have exit rights. But we, of course, do have entry rights. And that's what this debate is all about. I, of course, disagree with his analysis of the congressional debates. I think he said at one point that the concept of jus soli doesn't appear anywhere in the congressional debates. That's simply not true. And in fact, it appears at the very beginning of the debate. Senator Howard is the one who introduces this language into the discussion. And in his introduction of the language, he says expressly that this amendment, which I have offered, is simply declaratory of what I regard as the law of the land already, namely English common law, that every person born within the limits of the United States and subject to their jurisdiction is by virtue of natural law and national law a citizen of the United States. And he goes on in a very important statement, quote, "This will not, of course, include persons born in the United States who are foreigners, aliens, who belong to the families of ambassadors or foreign ministers accredited to the government of the United States, but it will include every other class of persons." That's an express reference, of course, to the diplomatic immunity concepts that Dr. Eastman acknowledges is part of the English common law doctrine. I confess I just don't understand why the discussion of Chinese nationals and other foreign nationals wouldn't cover this issue. At the end of the day, I understood the position to be that it's got to be about allegiance, not merely obedience. If it's allegiance, then it's U.S. citizens only, and everybody else will be excluded. And that's, of course, not what the Congress contemplated.
I mean, yeah, Jim, it's good that you pick up on the Howard thing because you made a slight twist there when you said you repeated his exact words, and then you redefined them when you said, namely, the old common law. He, of course, never says, namely, the old common law. When he says this will give citizenship consistent with the law as it stands now, he's referring back not to the common law rule of jus soli. He is explicitly referring back, later in the debate we learn that it's explicitly referring back, to the 1866 Act, which says all persons born here and not subject to any foreign power will be citizens. That's the law as it stands right now that he's referring, not the common law of birth being sufficient. And then the other language that you cite where it says this will not apply to the children of foreigners, aliens, and of ambassadors. You're reading it as if the first part of that, foreigners and aliens, is a subset of ambassadors or a parallel use of language to ambassadors, and subsuming it all under the ambassadorial exception. But he is saying that if you're the child of a foreigner who still owes allegiance to your foreign power, there's the 1866 Act, as well as being a child of an ambassador because of this fiction of extraterritoriality, two different pieces, neither of those would be citizens. Now, we get a shorthand from the summary, and, you know, it says foreigners, aliens, children of ambassadors. It's a comma. Is it all part of one set, or is it two sets? It's a little hard to say from the summary, but if you look at everything else he said during the course of the debates, it's clear that he's referring back to the 1866 Act, which quite explicitly is not a jus soli act. It says born here and not subject to any foreign power. Now, there are a couple of categories of people that fit that. Obviously, the children of citizens fit that. But also, because of the consent model and the fact that we repudiated the notion that you were once a king's subject, always a king's subject, and you could never renounce it, and we had 50 years of fights with Great Britain about impressment of U.S. sailors because they had previously been British subjects about that very question, and we rejected it. And so if a Chinese immigrant comes to the United States and wants to renounce his citizenship or his being subject to the Emperor of China, the human rights view, the consent-based model that we adopt in the Declaration of Independence, says that he's allowed to do that, and then he is no longer subject to any foreign power. And if he's here lawfully and permanently with our permission, there's our half of the consent model, then his children will be citizens according to the 14th Amendment. But without that step of becoming a lawful permanent resident and renouncing by deed, and once you take the citizenship step as well, renouncing explicitly the former allegiance, then you fit into that category that Howard is talking about as people explicitly not covered, the children of foreigners and aliens, as well as the children of ambassadors who are born here on U.S. soil.
If I could just very briefly go back to the Senator Howard quote. Respectfully, I just don't see it as a plausible interpretation of what he's saying. When he refers to those born in the United States who are foreigners, aliens, who belong to the families of ambassadors, I suppose Dr. Eastman's point is that those are separate categories, that they're excluding foreigners, excluding aliens, and also excluding ambassadors. Respectfully, that doesn't make any sense because all ambassadors are foreigners. I think the better and frankly the only plausible reading is that they were referring only to those foreigners and aliens who happen to be ambassadors. Otherwise, why even mention ambassadors? Obviously, all ambassadors are foreigners, so if we were trying to exclude all foreigners, we might as well have just said exclude all foreigners and never once mention ambassadors.
Well, you could go the other direction as well. Then we by saying foreigners and aliens and ambassadors, then we're just being redundant because I could have just said ambassadors if that's all I meant. The fact that he said foreigners and aliens as well suggests that this is broader than you're trying to limit it to be, in his view. And on the consent principle again, the consent principle that we codify in the Declaration of Independence or articulate in the Declaration of Independence had two sides to it. That it required that you have the authority to renounce your allegiance whenever you want. And there's a huge debate over 50, 60 years trying to work out that principle. What if we're about to go to war and we need all the troops that we can get to put on the battlefield? Are you allowed to renounce your citizenship then and your allegiance then? All of those things have to get worked out over time. But the flip side of it is the entry part. And yes, it's true. The entry part is grounded in consent. That means two-way consent. The body politic as well as the individual have to agree to it for it to be consent. Otherwise, it's a demand of citizenship in a body politic that is not yours. And it violates the consent principle to say that the nation that you want to join doesn't have a say in whether you join. And yet when people come here unlawfully, in violation of law, in fact, in derogation expressly of the consent that we have given to others, we're not adopting a consent-based model, as the Declaration suggests we should be. We're adopting something entirely else. And so I think when you look at the philosophical traditions that lead up to debates, yes, of course, Howard is talking about two different categories. He's talking about the exclusion that the subject to the jurisdiction phrase means as being broader than just this very, very narrow subset of ambassadors. But the children of foreigners who continue to owe allegiance to their home country and therefore are not subject to our jurisdiction in this more complete sense. And it's that language during the Indian discussion, when they are very explicit that it means the complete jurisdiction, not the partial or territorial jurisdiction, that really is dispositive on that issue.
Dean, this is Jim Ho again. If I could just go back to the Howard language just one final last time.
And then I want to ask a question of each of you, but go ahead, Jim.
Absolutely, and this will be quick. I think Dr. Eastman's kind of smuggling in an extra word there. It doesn't say foreigners and aliens and ambassadors. It says foreigners, aliens who belong to the families of ambassadors. And I would just submit that that's obviously one entire clause that's being excluded.
Well, no, you just left out a word. It says foreigners, aliens, those who belong to the family of ambassadors. And so you're reading it as the second half, kind of picking up on the first half. And remember, this is not a transcript of the debate. This is somebody's notes from what that debate was. And so we don't have the exact intonation on whether he's speaking in two different categories or one. And that means it's ambiguous. And that means you have to look at the broader philosophical principles when the issue is pressed in different contexts elsewhere in the debates, whether we're talking territorial jurisdiction or complete jurisdiction. And because he so clearly comes down on the side of complete jurisdiction in the Indian discussion, I think that's a better reading that he meant complete jurisdiction here as well.
Terrific. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Let me ask a couple questions. One question of each of you, and if you want to answer these questions, fine. If you want to continue in a different line, that's fine as well. But for Dr. Eastman, you talk about allegiance, and you've talked about intent and people coming here illegally, and you're pretty freely imputing the intent from the parents to the child, who's many people would characterize as completely innocent, and doesn't have any allegiance, doesn't have any intent, did not intend to come here illegally, but was brought here. So I wonder if you'd address that. And then for Mr. Ho, Jim, you know, the world has changed quite a bit, you know, since the times of these debates. Illegal immigration is not a new phenomenon, but even definitions have changed, and it's certainly a different problem than it once was. These people, at least nowadays, a lot of people think that some illegal immigrants are coming here for the specific purpose of having a child here, whereas in the past, having a child being born here of foreign nationals maybe is just an incident of those people coming here for otherwise legal purposes. So I wonder if you could address that.
So this is John taking up the first question. You know, it's the parents who are here unlawfully. And by the way, my proposition applies to parents who are here lawfully but only temporarily as tourists or on a temporary work permit, who retain their allegiance to their home country and intend to go back, and who have not been extended an offer to stay here permanently and lawfully. And yes, the children obviously at 1 day or 1 year or 5 years or even 17 years are not able to issue the consent. We have always imputed the parents' allegiance to the children until the children come of age and can make the descent decision themselves. And because the parent, the child retains the allegiances through his parents that the parents have to the home country in the case of a temporary visitor or in particular of an unlawful visitor to the United States, somebody who never had our permission to be here, they retain their allegiance to the foreign power as well. And that's true almost universally. There are a couple of nations in the world that would refuse to recognize the citizenship status of those children because they're born on U.S. soil, and they would be stateless children. Although because they don't owe allegiance to any foreign power, I think a decent argument can be made under the 14th Amendment that at least that subcategory of children would be U.S. citizens. That would have to be worked out. But the broader principle that the children owe their allegiance through their parents until they come of age is one that is accepted both in the jus soli and the what's called jus sanguinis, that it comes through the parents' propositions. And under that consent-based model, they are simply not subject to the jurisdiction in the United States in this complete sense that is required under the 14th Amendment. Of course, we could change the rule. Congress could say, you know, we like the notion that anybody born here, we like the ingenuity and the entrepreneurship of getting here, even if you violate our laws to do it, so we're going to reward you with citizenship for your children. We could do that as a matter of naturalization policy. My point is that the Constitution's 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause doesn't do that, and there are very good policy reasons to be concerned about adopting such a rule, in part because it's a huge magnet, and maybe not the largest magnet, but it is a significant one for illegal immigration, which creates a situation where we've got people who get preyed upon while they're trying to get here in order to get this lottery ticket of U.S. citizenship for their kids, and then they continue to get preyed on while they're here, and living kind of in the shadows, afraid to even report crimes against them to the police. That's something we ought not to be encouraging. And every one of the magnets that puts them in that position, we ought to get rid of, while at the same time expand the path for legal immigration broadly, streamline it, not make people wait in line for years to get here, welcome them under our law and on our terms into accepting the propositions that we have articulated in our government. That's the kind of consent I think the Declaration ascribes, holds out as our hope, and I think it's codified in the 14th Amendment.
To your question about, I guess it's really a question of, is birthright citizenship, is the citizenship clause essentially obsolete? Sort of understanding that the English common law rule is a centuries old rule that we simply incorporated, but you know, maybe it's a little obsolete in the modern era of easy interstate and international transportation and travel, and therefore in an era where maybe, you know, the fact that you happen to be born in a certain place just doesn't really quite mean what it used to, and so whether that means anything. Now, I have two answers to that. Now, first is the obvious point that all Federalists should embrace, which is just because a provision of the Constitution seems obsolete in modern times, that doesn't mean we can ignore it. Obviously, there still is a constitutional amendment process. You know, the institution of slavery was obviously should have been obsolete at the outset, but it still took a constitutional amendment to abolish it. But really, to really get at the heart of your question, what I would submit is this. Even if we were to assume that one's place of birth is in fact an obsolete concept, then I would think that before we got rid of birthright citizenship, we should first take a look at Article 2 of the Constitution. After all, under Article 2, only a natural-born citizen can be president. I don't hear any arguments that somebody who was not a natural-born citizen, like Governor Schwarzenegger, could somehow become president without amending the Constitution first.
And here, let me agree with Jim. If the 14th Amendment means what he says it means, it would take a constitutional amendment to change it. I am fully in agreement with that. Our disagreement is whether it means what he says it means or means what I believe it means. And for that, we have a whole slew of tools that we use to try and figure out what those that drafted it, and in particular, what the words would have meant to those that ratified it. And when you look at the debates from those who drafted it, that convey, in my view, this understanding of a consent-based model, that's the best indication we have of what the terms meant to those that were ratifying it, because the ratification debates are very sporadic on this. This is the best source of information, and we've just got to come to grips with what it means. But if he's right about what it means, that it means, you know, birth on U.S. soil, no matter how you got here, lawfully, unlawfully, overstayed a visa, never had a visa in the first place, you know, we're a drug runner crossing the border, or a terrorist, like Hamdi turns out to be, it doesn't matter. You get that birth on U.S. soil, you got the magic card of U.S. citizenship. I don't think that's what it meant at the time, so I don't think amendment is required to get back to what I think is a more sensible policy, that you've got to have some connection to the United States and not be have an allegiance to a foreign power in order to claim this automatic citizenship.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. This has been an enlightening discussion, and we certainly appreciate your participation in our podcast today.
Thanks, Dean.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society.
Thank you to our audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Again, that's federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you again for listening.